Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Read just in on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, and I'm feeling so good, so good. Whoa, whoa, hungry. A fish in the sea, you know how I feel. Little bird running free, you know how I feel. Blast someday on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new day, it's a new dawn, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I need. Butterflies all having fun, you know what I need. Sleep in peace when the day is done, that's what I need. And the soul world is a new world, and a bold world. Expect a man, a white man, to do it. Let me know. Say, you know how I feel.
I feel like
that. Don't you lie.
You know.
It's a new dawn, it's a new day, and I'm feeling good. People of the world, I'm your host, GD. Welcome to iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is Wednesday, July 2nd, 2014. Where did the time go? The time is 1:30 p.m., and we are in the midst of a summer time. That was pop icon George Michael belting out the late Nina Simone's Feeling Good. And I am definitely feeling good on this summer day today, and I hope you're feeling good as well. She is a third-generation publisher, published author, and CEO of Happy Publishing. Her first book, Prospect When You Are Happy, and her second book, Happiness Quotations, were published in 2011. Happiness Quotations, Gentle Reminders of Your Preciousness, is a lovely series of passages designed to uplift, inspire, and encourage you to live an inspired day every day. She became a newspaper reporter straight out of the University of California, Davis, starting a gig at the Dixon Tribune, quickly becoming a writer for the Sacramento Bee, which covered communities north of Sacramento, heading into the foothills of Nevada City, including Yuba City, Marysville, Bayou, and Colusa. She was hired by the Bee to write for the Santa Barbara News Press, which right after the New York Times purchased. In the 90s, she relocated to San Francisco Bay Area, becoming the director of public relations for KTEH Public Television, then worked for 6 or 7 years for the family foundation of Andy and Eva Grove, Intel co-founder and his wife. She was the first employee for this foundation and built it with the family. And it had an astounding $1.3 million to $7 million in annual giving. Pretty phenomenal, right? Well, it's time to spill the joy here over the airwaves. Her name is Erica Glessing, and she joins me on iArtist Presents here on Untouched Grace, and I welcome her to the show with a warm, bright smile. Welcome to the show, Erica. How are you doing today?
Oh, I am doing so well, and I am joyful to be here with you. Thank you, GD.
Why? Well, thank you, and I appreciate you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join myself and the listeners here on A Touch of Grace. So for the next hour, we're going to talk about the amazing positive vibes that you are hurling into the universe each day. Yep, you're hurling it. And the first question is, where did it all begin? Where were you born, and what were the early years like for Erica Glessing?
All right, so I'm a Californian born and raised, so I was born in Sausalito, California. My dad was working at the time at the San Francisco Chronicle, and he was also a publisher at that time with my mom, and then we moved to Berkeley. So I lived in Berkeley, oh my gosh, till like almost the end of elementary school. And I was there during all the integration. It was a pretty exciting time in Berkeley many years back, and I got to experience some of the civil rights stuff that was going on at the time. My family was somewhat political and engaged in some of the work to overcome. And we used to sing, I'm not kidding, we used to sing Holding Hands at Hillside Elementary School in Berkeley. We would sing We Shall Overcome, like every morning.
Wow.
That was my early days, baby.
Wow. Well, I have to tell you right now, I was born in the 60s, too. Now, I can honestly say that I don't recall a lot of the experiences that were taking place around the nation as, you know, the nation struggled to, you know, just unite in spite of color or race or religion, to just be a whole country that embraces all genders, nationalities, and religious preferences. So what an exciting time for you. And that song, We Shall Overcome, I just can't help but I see Martin Luther King in my head. So what an exciting time in your life to have experienced that. So in addition to that, was there one experience that affected your spirit profoundly and started you on the path of happiness?
Well, you know, actually the image that showed up for me, I think is somewhat connected with you maybe in the last couple of weeks as we lost the author Maya Angelou. And I remember in college she came and spoke, and I so wanted desperately to be a poet at the time. And, you know, I can remember my mother saying, you will never make money as a poet, you know. You need a real job, right? And now I'm writing about happiness, and you know what? They're a little bit like poems. I'm just saying.
Well, I have to tell
but
you
I
right
that,
now.
But I have that memory, yeah.
Well, I have to tell you, Erica, there's nothing more profound and needed constantly is and that's happiness in this world. So you got a chance to be in the presence of Maya Angelou in college. So what was her presence like? What do you remember about that time?
She had a very intense persona. She was very bubbly and friendly, and she shook every single one of our hands. Like, she stopped and said hello and talked to every single, I think it was mostly girls, if I recall. It was mostly women in the room. And I think she just pretty much spent time with each of us saying hello. She was very caring. And then her poems were just so moving. And that kind of made a pretty deep impression on me as a young poet and writer. So the happiness stuff, the writing about happiness came, you know, many years later. I would say the happiness stuff, although I've always been I've always been like a glass of champagne, as everyone says.
Oh, wow, I like that. I got to remember that one.
Yeah, right? That's my energy, is that bubbly, happy. You're a glass of champagne, Erica. I don't know how many times people have said that to me.
Well, I have to tell
you
right now.
I started writing about it, yeah, maybe in around 2007, I think, when I started writing about it.
Wow, I like that. You were like a glass of champagne, because I know that when you and I sat down in person, I could easily see you were bubbly, you were definitely spirited, and you were definitely a class act, is what I could say. So let's talk about, yeah, indeed. So let's talk about that first piece that you ever wrote. Do you remember what that first piece was and the theme of the article?
Oh, my goodness, no. You know what, honey? I think I started writing when I was like 11 or 10, and I've written poems and songs for all those years. I have journals. I have boxes and boxes of things and poems I've written over the years, and I write every single day. So at one point, I kind of tried to count, and I had over 5,000 articles published, magazine
wow.
articles published. I'm on about 6 books now published. I don't think there was a time when I wasn't writing. I do have another college memory, and it was a poet whose name was B.F. Mays, and he came and spoke, and I got so excited, I wrote him a poem, and I don't know how I got it to him. I don't remember if I like stalked him. I can't remember. somehow I gave him the poem. So like, you know, a couple months go by, maybe 6-8 weeks go by, and I'm living in, you know, in a college campus, and I get this phone call, and you know, you're not listed at that time, you know, in college, it's not like you're listed. And I get this call. And he's like, this is B.F. Mays, and you're hard to track down. I'm like, what? I'm like, what? And he says, you know, he said to me, I remember exactly, he said, when art begets art, like that is just so beautiful. And he asked permission to put my poem on his next book cover. And I was
that's
like, fast. Whoa.
Yeah, that has to have been a thrilling experience for you. So it sounds to me like that was one of the profound moments in your life with this B.F. Mays. I'm going to have to do a Google search and find out a little bit more about him. So now he actually used your poem. Did you actually see the book? Did he send it to you and autograph it? Or how did you go about seeing your work?
After that, it gets kind of fuzzy. So I don't remember. Like, I don't know if he just called and got my permission. I can't remember if I ever actually got the book in hand, I must say. I can't remember that.
Well, that sounds like it could be a little adventure for you to go ahead and find that, because I'm pretty sure it's out there somewhere. And that's one thing about, you know, art. I mean, I have a blog, and I've written hundreds of uplifting words of encouragement, and I chronicle my life, and there's so much stuff out there right now. I think I'm just like you, to be honest. It's like I can't tell you. I would recognize something that I wrote, but I couldn't tell you just like detail what those were and what the earlier ones were.
Mm.
But let's talk, so in the intro I mentioned that you are a third generation published author. So who were the two people before you that helped pave the way for you?
Well, my grandfather ran a press. So I call that a publisher. He would publish people. So they would come in, and he ran a printing press. And in one of my books, there's a picture of me sitting at one of the big, huge machines of setting type in the 20s and 30s in New York. And so that was ink, and that was my, you know, very early times visiting my grandfather in his print shop. And he would publish people. So he would publish all kinds of publications and books. And then both my parents were newspaper publishers,
mm-hmm.
and so I was raised in that environment of, and they, typically my dad would do the hard print press stuff. At that time, there were really big machines that actually printed the newspapers, And so to this day, I mean, they don't really, a lot of that stuff's done differently now, but when I walk into a building where they have a printing press, you know, that's like some of my earliest childhood memories is being in those big rooms where the papers are being printed and rolling off the presses.
Wow, wow. And I actually remember those too, though I've never seen one firsthand. And I got a chance to see a movie that was the final actual printed publishing of Life magazine, and I think it was definitely
a
work of fiction, but it was Walter Mitty,
mm-hmm.
and it was Ben Stiller, and it was this crazy tale about this last final picture from this, you know, crazy guy that would go out all over the world and take pictures doing just amazing things, like standing on top
mm-hmm.
of an airplane, you know, flying. So, you know, I just know that we have come and evolved so much from those big printing presses. Everything is more digital now, but you actually got a chance to witness that. Wow. So what was life like living with both parents who were publishers?
Well, then, so my dad ended up becoming a journalism professor. My mom went into television and became a producer at KQED, and she actually won an Emmy for her work. So starting at about age 10, I started getting dragged onto TV sets. And so the funny thing is I'm actually much more comfortable in my body and happy on a TV set than like mm-hmm. almost any other environment. So it's very interesting when I get my clients now, when I get them on TV, and I'll take them with me to the studios, and I'm like, relax, it's okay. And I'm smiling and joking with everybody, you know. It's like because the TV studio actually became then, because my mom kind of morphed from print into television in the late 70s. And so in the early 80s, all in that time, I started getting into learning about TV from the producer's eyes. And that was always really interesting. My first love was books. And so, you know, books took me away. Books gave me salvation. Books gave me hope. Books connected me with my joy. I love so many of the poets that influenced my life. And so when I look at my life, you know, the TV studio and the print and the, you know, we must have gotten 7 newspapers at our house.
Wow.
Yeah, we got the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Daily Paper, and, like, the Weekly Paper, and then we get, like, Time Magazine, and, I mean, and then every single one, my dad would open up and show me which pictures were good, which eyes were more compelling, why someone shouldn't be looking off the paper, why this headline is good, why this headline is bad. I mean, I was like, you know, bottle fed on journalism.
Yeah, I could hear it. You know what it reminded me of when you were talking is I have a lot of entertainers that come on Street Player Presents on the segment on the show, and they always talk about how their mother or their father did a lot of singing around the house. So this is the very first time in history on A Touch of Grace that I've actually heard parents that are cultivating a young journalist and a writer, and I just think that it is just fascinating to have lived in a household where, you know, journalism and publishing was, you know, prevalent. I think that that is just phenomenal, but I want to go back, and I want to talk about your mom's Emmy. So she worked for KQED. So do you remember that moment? Was your mom, did your mom go to the event at the Emmys, or did she
find out
at home? She did?
No, she went. Yeah, it was a big deal what she was going to wear. she created a precursor that, like, later Oprah and the daytime shows with meaning. So she wanted to do an alternative to soap operas. So mm-hmm. she got this woman named Jerry Lange. And it was Ted Lange. I think you say it Lange. It's L-A-N-G-E. He was on the Love Boat, so it's his mom. And she was the host of the program. And they did women's topics, like how to get house insurance. And I just remember her, before the show got created, saying, Erica, I'm going to do a show that's not about soap operas. I'm like, okay, Mom, like, whatever. She goes, no, it's so exciting. I'm going to make it about really important topics during the daytime. All the fun now is soap operas. And I remember looking at my mom and going, you know, okay, Mom. Like, I was 11, right? I'm like, all right, whatever, if it makes you happy, Mom. And so she did, and it became a national program on PBS, ran nationally, and won an Emmy Award in the documentary category. So I have the Emmy because my mom's passed, so I have it at home.
Yeah, I was wondering. So what is the Emmy made out of? Is it just like metal?
You know what? It's like a faux gold-plated thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty heavy.
Oh, wow. So when your mom came home, because I know the Emmys, I think they're shot in Hollywood, California. So what were her stories like from that evening where she won that Emmy? Did she tell you any exciting experiences during that time? No?
Nope, I didn't hear anything. I'm deprived.
Well, your mom sounds like she was an amazing woman, and I have to tell you right now, the whole meaningful topic thing really did take off with Oprah Winfrey, because, you know, talk shows at the time when Oprah came, they were really more about controversial things such as racism and, you know, you are not the baby daddy and, you know, those type
right.
of things. I think
Remember.
It's fantastic. It,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And whereas soap operas were dominating the airwaves at that time, now reality shows seem to be dominating the market as well. So, God, what
oh, my
exciting.
Gosh, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, well, so did you feel famous after your mom got that Emmy?
My mom was on television a lot on Channel 9. So I was, I was on TV sometime. Everyone saw my mom. So, yeah, she was pretty famous. She was very beautiful, blonde, leggy.
Yeah.
And everyone recognized her, and yeah, she was pretty famous. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I know that you talk about your father and your mom. Your father was a journalism professor. Let's talk about him for a second. So he was a journalism professor where? What school was he a professor?
At Kenyatta. Kenyatta
really?
Community College.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
He loved helping. He wanted to. My dad was raised in the streets of upstate New York, real poor. He was kind of came from an abused background. He was a little bit wild. My dad had some issues with drugs. He ran pretty fast. He was not a saint. He's still alive. He's just kind of he's in Southern California now. He ran kind of fast and wild, but he was a brilliant writer and loved to teach kids who couldn't write at all and really show them that they could. And so he worked a lot in the trenches, and some of his students went on and won big writing awards. So I do hear from his students occasionally that went on and became journalists and writers. And my dad just loved writing so much. So he gave a lot. He had a book called The Underground Press in America that was published by Indiana University Press, and it was and probably still is the book on underground press in America.
And you know what, and who best to tell it except for one who was deeply involved at that time. So what's your dad's name?
Robert Glessing.
Robert Glessing. And what about your mom?
Her name was Martha Glessing.
Martha Glessing. So, God, your parents sound amazing. I have to tell you right now, I would love to have been a fly on the wall in your home to actually see the interactions, you know, having parents who actually live and were following their passion. I think that people who follow their passion are some of the happier people in life. And you had mentioned your father's substance abuse issues as well. But, you know, a lot of the times the passion can kind of parallel it and you know, they could actually rise above it. So hopefully he has got that under control. So the question that I have, having such accomplished parents, did you ever feel the pressure to be able to live up to their standards, or did you have your own set of principles and rules that you were following?
You know, the thing that I get is that I was like hardwired to become a writer. Like, mm-hmm. I was always going to be, and as I wrote, I was always gifted for it, paid for it, published for it, honored mm-hmm. for it, rewarded for it. I think early on, my writing was recognized in most environments as a gift. Mm-hmm. I think, like, we talk a little bit sometimes, like, things can be an invisible environment.
Mm-hmm.
I think really for me that was just like all I knew. So I don't know that there was it was more like every time I did anything with writing, my parents were doing cartwheels. It was more like positively rewarded. I actually, part of me feels like, from my perspective, both of them could have taken their careers even bigger. Mm-hmm. Like, both of them's careers could have gotten brighter. Or I feel like maybe at some points they pulled back from their own brilliance. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel pressure to live bigger because, like, they had so much they didn't get to finally express. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It actually does make sense. And so the question that I have is, do you have any thoughts about why you think they stifled their brilliance?
Yeah, I'm not clear where, like, the fear of all the fame and all the, because they started getting fame and celebrity. My dad was on television. They started getting noticed and recognized when we go out. That was never, like, something they were comfortable in, that environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and it makes sense. I mean, it's a lot, you know. Living life in the spotlight does come with it a whole set of other things that you have to deal with and challenges, you know. Sometimes that can really overshadow the creativity part of it. And having been a fan of television and film and books and music, I just see that some entertainers or some people that are creative, you know, even though their work is great and this is the gift that they were given, you know, to be thrust into a mainstream that is very fast-paced, unforgiving, critical. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes along with being in the spotlight. And when I think about your parents, you know, kind of like selecting their path that they want to go, you know, and making sure that they had control. And it sounds to me like they were very controlled about how far they wanted to go. It reminds me of Dave Chappelle. He's a comedian. And he was presented with, like, this $10 million deal, and he walked away from it. And when asked about it in the entertainer studio on television, he said that, you know, it comes with so much pressure and high expectations that you really don't wind up living your life. You're actually living the life of a celebrity, you know. So I think that your parents definitely were something special to say that they didn't go for the bright lights and the glamour, especially after your mother won that Emmy. So now you live in a household with parents who were writers and publishers. And so I wanted to talk about the University of California, Davis. You had mentioned that, you know, Maya Angelou came to visit. But what was that entire college experience like for you? And was there a professor or professors that tapped into your skills and then offered to cultivate your talent?
You know, I still don't quite get why I chose that university. I think it was like a little, to be honest, it's going to be crazy, but, you know, when I went up there, it was like, it was just the right distance away. You know, it was like a challenge for me academically. I was interested in the challenge. And it just felt like a place where I could be. I don't think at that time any of the teachers or professors understood me. It was a very pre-med, pre-vet, pre-law, pre-engineer, pre-chemical engineer environment.
Wow.
And really nobody got me pretty much at all of any of my professors. I don't think I really had an experience there, except that I wasn't squished, you know. I got a lot of joy writing for it was called the Third World Forum, and I was sitting there trying to get a waitress job. Couldn't get any waitress job. I must have applied at like I don't know how many places. I'm sitting there reading this paper, and it was called Third World Forum or the People's Monitor or something like that. I'm reading it. And I'm like, I'm sitting there with my girlfriends. I'm like, look at that typo. Look at that headline. Oh, my gosh, this should be written like that, right? And she goes, you know what? If you feel like that, you go down, you help them, right?
Okay.
And I remember I walked down the stairs. It was in this really funny little, oh, my gosh, all these stairs. I go down the bottom. It's like in this basement. No light at all. No room. You know, the room's just like artificial light. I walk in. And it's people of all different backgrounds, and like a woman from India, I think, was the editor, and then a big old black guy was the Fundi Hatari, I think was his name. He was like the managing something or other. And then this other guy, I think his name was Vince, was the photographer. And I'm like, I do layout, and I can do headlines and things like that. Can I help you guys? And I ended up getting paid to do that because the college paid for work like that, the university. There was a budget. And I just got my first job on the campus at the People's Monitor. And I stayed there for several years, and I wrote lots of stories. I got to interview Tootsin, the Maytals, and Alvin Ailey dance troupe. And,
wow.
Oh, my gosh, I had a blast. And everybody I got to interview, they'd let me go backstage. And actually, I think Fundi was also a photographer because I remember going backstage with him at some of these events when musicians would come up and play. And I remember him coming and taking the pictures while I would do the articles. And so that was maybe that was my first newspaper job.
Okay. So you said India, black guy. It sounded like there was a melting pot of individuals that
were down in that basement. Yeah, it was a publication for women and people of color.
Okay. And the college paid for it. You know, I find that interesting because, you know, there's this big to-do about, you know, college athletes actually being paid for it. And I don't know if it even on the table, but it's interesting that they would actually pay for writers there at the college. So that sounds like it's pretty cool. Did you make a lot of money with it, or was it just like a little gift type of payment?
Well, I put myself through college, and that was one of my jobs. I don't remember how much I made, but I mean, I worked for them, I don't know, 15 hours a week, something like that.
And during that 15 hours a week, so during that time, what was something that you took away from that experience that further helped shape who you became today?
I can remember walking on the campus, and I had tried to get an interview with the head of Alvin Ailey, which is a dance troupe. And I had tried to get an interview with the head of Alvin Ailey, and I'd gotten the runaround. I mean, I was only like 19, right? 20. And I hadn't been able to get an interview with them. And I remember I was walking on campus, and I see this woman, and she's got, like, really pretty hair, and it's all up. Like, dancers have those, like, pretty high cheekbones, and she had her hair all back. And I said, hi, how are you doing? She goes, do you know how to get to so-and-so? And I'm like, sure. And I go, are you a dancer? And she goes, yes, I'm with Alvin Ailey. And I got to do an interview.
Wow.
And I just kind of worked my way in, and she brought me backstage, and I got to meet the people who were running it. And those kinds of things would always happen to me. I would be in the right place at the right time. And that really, as a newspaper reporter, proved so helpful, that sort of sixth sense, is I could always kind of – I remember time after time I would break news because I would be in a place where news was happening, and I would notice it. And I would ask the question, and then I'd find out something that was breaking news. And I first kind of figured that out in my experience as a journalist on the UC Davis campus.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a wonderful experience. Well, let's talk about graduation day. Do you remember it And was it like a rite of passage for you that escalated your move into more mainstream writing?
I think I was like eager to get a job, glad to be done. It wasn't all that. It was like all right. I don't know. I remember being excited about my first job in a newspaper of going out and getting one, you know.
And so that very first one was the Sacramento Bee, if I'm correct. Is that you went to work for the Sacramento Bee
Metropolitan? My straight out of college was a Dixon Tribune.
Okay, and so what was that experience like? Because doesn't it put you in the field where you're actually, like I mentioned, some of the places that you covered? So when you're talking about places that you've covered, those are places where you go into the town and, you know, find something that is newsworthy or breaking news? Or what does that look like? What does that process look like?
Gosh, you know what? I was paid to be nosy.
Erica, I just love your honesty. So
you know what, honey? I would interview people just like you're interviewing me. I would interview people every day. I would write 6-7 articles every week, and I would just always have my ear to the ground and sniffing out stories and looking for news. And I covered the basketball team, the football team, and Dixon, the baseball team.
Wow.
Plus all the schools. I was the only news reporter, and we actually, that year, the newspaper, I was the only writer, and they won a big award, which is General Excellence from the California Newspaper Publishers Association. And General Excellence is like the best award you can get for a publication. And that year, when I was the only writer, they won it. So that was another good, like, yes, Erica, you're on your track, you're on your path, right?
Right, right. So as a writer and an interviewer, because I know sometimes on this show I try not to get too Wendy Williamish, you know, and pry too deep into their lives. So do you have something within you that says, okay, maybe I won't ask this question because it might be too invasive? And also, when you're interviewing someone that's not really a great interview, how do you break through to actually get the story that you want to present?
You know what? I think what I'm doing, I never came at things with that big of a, like, I never had that much of an agenda. So I was always interested in the truth.
Okay.
And to this day, like, when I choose authors in my books, I look for that truth, you know? I look for, are they authentic? Are they being themselves? I have a gift of people feel really comfortable and safe around me. I can interview children. They will typically open up with me. The shyest person in the world usually around me, I'm usually going to put them at ease and help them feel like I will get them and I won't mess up, you know, misperceive what they're telling me, you know? And there's also always more than one way to tell a story. So it's never going to be just one person you interview. It's going to – I remember I interviewed this beautiful man when I was at Dixon, and he was a photographer, Daniel DiAgostini. And I drove up to his family's winery to interview him. And, oh, my gosh, his mom later said I wrote the best article about him she'd ever read. Like, she said I captured his spirit, and he was so shy.
Oh, wow, okay.
He was like, give me a camera. I don't talk.
Wow.
And somehow I was able to just kind of, like, pull the story piece it from his actions and his behaviors and his beautiful photos. And I could sort of see what motivated him because he helped so many children with his art. And so I wrote a little bit about the children. I had the children tell me a little bit about what it meant to them to have him teach photography to them. And I just kind of like told the story, but I remember he was like pretty nonverbal.
Oh, wow. Well, that answers my question. So on the flip side, was there ever a story that triggered you emotionally as you were writing it?
Oh, constantly. Oh my gosh, I wrote so many stories. I wrote a lot of tear-jerking stories. I'm trying to think of one. Stories that made me cry. You know, the stories that make me cry the most are when someone overcomes great obstacles, mm-hmm. and it's like and manages to break through and become something bigger than they were. And then that often will make me cry when they've. I've written so many hundreds of those. It's hard for me to just think about one. There was one story I wrote about a boy who got paralyzed. It was in Santa Barbara. And he was paralyzed from waist down, and he managed to graduate from high school despite this huge illness that had him in the hospital, you know, for like a year and a half. And he also had like a degenerative disease. So it was like his body was degenerating, and he was in a wheelchair, and he'd gone through this horrible experience, and he had just said to himself, I'm going to graduate from high school. I'm going to graduate from high school. And he did. And so he got to go across the stage and get his diploma in his wheelchair. And that story really moved me, that he stuck in there and was able to not get put off by all the things that his body was having such challenges. And I think his parents also communicated to me how much the story meant to them. People would like keep stories that I wrote and tell me like 15 years later what it meant to them.
Okay.
I've always been kind of blessed like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I really like a lot of what you said. You talked about being more interested in the truth and, you know, capturing spirit, you know, which means that makes you an honest writer as well, genuine. And I could definitely certainly feel it when I'm reading something, if something is just kind of fabricated or just too over the top to actually grasp onto. So I think that's incredible work that you have been doing. What a wonderful legacy you are continuing to create every day. So in addition to those types of stories, were there stories that just struck a constant wrong chord in you and it affected you adversely as far as emotional?
Well, the reason I left journalism was some of the focus on the negative. So mm-hmm. that was what caused me to switch from journalism to philanthropy. So at some point, I just got tired of the, you know, the overall focus of media in general on the negative, mm-hmm. On the fatals, on how many people have been killed, who's done this to who, you know. That did get old for me, and I had to switch into something that was in the positivity. And I never looked back. So that was good, I think, for me to move into writing about happiness, joy, breaking through how we are able to take our energy and have beautiful things happen in our lives, and all the power that comes from things like music and joy, and really standing in that energy. And I outgrew the newspaper business in about 1993. So.
Okay. All right. Well, what we're going to do
there
is we're going to go ahead and – well, thank you very much. I'm certainly enjoying this interview. I'm going to really enjoy going back listening to it. That's when I get more out of the interview, when I actually go back and listen to them. Because I'm here. Are you there? Hello, Erica? Hello? Uh-oh. I think we just lost Erica, everybody. But stand by. Erica? Okay, so what we're going to do right now, I'm going to
go Glenn, ahead. Hey, Glenn, can you repeat that question? Because my audio is cutting out.
Oh, that's okay. There you go. Well, what I wanted to do is I'm going to go ahead and take a music break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about Santa Barbara. We're going to talk about the three powerful gifts of writing that a book gives. So I want you to kick back for a moment. We're going to go ahead and regroup.
Hello?
And after this music break, are you there? I'm here. Okay, something's going on with Erica's audio. So what I want to do is I want to go ahead and I want to take a music break. And this one is called Nobody Greater, and it's by Vashon Mitchell. So kick back, and hopefully when we come back off the music break, we'll have Erica's audio situation figured out. Okay?
I'm having some audio. I'm not able to hear you, honey.
Okay, so let's go ahead and go into the music break, and then I'll work on getting Erica back, okay? This is Nobody Greater Than You, Vashon Mitchell.
The highest mountain, looked all around, couldn't find nobody. Went down into the deepest valley, looked all around down there, couldn't find nobody. I went across the deep blue sea, couldn't find one to compare to your grace, your love, your mercy. Nobody greater, nobody greater than you. Searched all over, couldn't find nobody. I looked high and low, still couldn't find nobody. Nobody greater, nobody greater, no, nobody greater than you. Nobody can heal like you can. Oh, most holy one, you are the great I am. Awesome in all your ways, and my hand. You are he who carried out redemption's plan. You are he who carried out redemption's plan. Nobody great, body greater, Jesus. Nobody greater than you. Nobody greater. Nobody greater, Jesus. Nobody greater than you.
Love that one. If you're joining us today, you just heard a music break. That was Vashon Mitchell singing Nobody Greater. I am interviewing publisher and author, Erica Glessing. She's a publisher of Happy Publishing, and we've just been having an intriguing conversation about how her life got started in this world of writing. So we are back. We were having some audio technical difficulties, but you know how the airwaves are with cell phones these days. So, Eric, I want to make sure you're here with us. Are you there?
I can hear you. Does that work for you right now?
It works for me very well. So thank you once again for doing this show. And it actually was almost perfect timing, probably divine intervention, because I love that song. I got that song off of your website, Nobody Greater Than You. So, you know, the words just stuck, and I wanted to surprise you today. So we've been talking about
I was like, how did you know I love that song?
You know what I have to tell you right now, that it gives me no greater pleasure than to actually play something on the air that that a guest is really in tune with. That's a beautiful song. I just love the words and everything. And having talked to you in person and for the first half of this interview, I could just honestly see why you love that song so much. So let's talk about your Santa Barbara News Press days, and then we're going to go ahead and get into three powerful gifts, writing a book gifts. So did you actually live in Santa Barbara when you were writing for them?
Oh, yeah, I did. I lived about 5 minutes from the newsroom.
Wow, yeah. And so, you know, I got a chance to see Santa Barbara on my route to Arizona. Me and my brother took the train. So that was the one station that we dropped off at, and when we came back, there were all these sailboats in the harbor. It was the most beautiful thing that I had ever seen. Mm. So what was your life like in Santa Barbara?
You know, that was just such a beautiful time of my life. I was making good money for the first time as a journalist because my other papers didn't pay that great. So I was making really good money. And the New York Times had bought the paper, so my stories were running in the New York Times wire. And that was really fun because they run all over the country. And it was beautiful to live there. And I had a really nice boyfriend at the time. And it was just it was a great place. I had some very good friends. And I think the beauty, the ocean air, the views, I ended up kind of outgrowing it a couple years later when I wanted to leave journalism and do something positive. And that's when I moved home to the San Francisco Bay Area. But Santa Barbara was really fun. And one of my friends, Terry Hunter Davis, who went on to work for the San Francisco Chronicle, and now she works for I think she works at UC Berkeley, she and I stayed friends from those days, and we've been friends for a couple decades now. So that good came out of that as well.
Well, I think that that is just one of the greatest things about each of the experiences that we have in our life is when we could take away, you know, good friendships that we have, you know, built. You know, I think that's this whole thing that some writers and some artists just, you know, kind of forget that, you know, you're stronger and powerful with other talented people in your life that encourage you during those times when, you know, you just kind of start doubting yourself. So we're going to talk about three powerful gifts writing a book gives, and I want to get your what your thoughts are about that statement, because I know that you have written them down, but I wanted you to expand on that. But was there ever a time in this journey, Erica, that you just said, God, what am I doing, you know, and you just doubted yourself and, you know, you had to regroup to reapproach it?
I've never had a doubt as far as my writing. So I've always written, I've said, you know, when my hand, if my hands go, I'm going to talk into the microphone. So, you know, like, I'm going to write till I'm dead, basically. You know, I'll be 92 sitting there, dang, I just got a new idea for a book.
Wow.
You know, you know what, that is something that is a gift, I feel like, comes bigger than me, from God, through me. I'm connected to Source when I'm writing. I'm in my zone of talking with God or being in that conversation of change on the planet and helping people, letting those words pour through me and not letting critical voice stop them. And I've always known I would write. I've always written and I always will write. So I don't know that for me, I mean, I have doubts in other areas of my life. I would not say in my writing space there's really any room for that.
Mm-hmm. You're incredible. I'm just going to enjoy. I'm so glad that Bonnie Mayshak introduced me to you. You are just an amazing spirit. And let's talk about Bonnie real briefly. Bonnie's book, The Dreams of Maddie Fitch, is now out in the market, and it is because of Erica that this has happened. So, Erica, how did you and Bonnie meet?
You know, this is really cool. The book that Bonnie wrote is so amazing, and we have a friend that I met in 2006-2007. We have a mutual friend, and Bonnie met Corinne in at some point, maybe through a class they took on writing, and so Corinne connected us, and so Corinne's up in Oregon. So Bonnie and I connected on phone calls and phone classes and phone stuff. And then after we actually started talking, turns out we went to I had moved to Palo Alto. We went to the same high school at almost the same time. She's just a little bit older than me. So how cool is that?
That's very cool. That's very cool. I remember when Bonnie told me about The Dreams of Maddie Fitch, because she grew up literally across the street from me on the corner house. And we actually got reconnected through Facebook. And when we got a chance to talk, she started telling me about this amazing book. And I just told her, I said, you know what, Bonnie? I said, you've already got it. So I had her on my show. Mm. And then she actually talked about, you know, publishing it. And she told me about this wonderful spirit known as Erica Glessing and how Erica was actually, you know, making these things happen for her. So I just want to say, you know, to Bonnie, once again, the importance of building relationships. You know, I've really got a good friend now in Erica Glessing. So let's talk about the three powerful gifts, writing a book gifts. Can you expand on that?
So, well, to begin with, I want to just say that if you're listening and there's a book that's, like, wanting to get born or it's thinking about being born, that it could be that that book is being called forth from something bigger than you, and that as you sit down to write it, it could be that it's being called through you to help others on the planet, so that in listening to that, that gift, you get more connected to God, and you can get more connected to your source. And the other thing that I just feel just continues to be true for my authors that I represent, they seem to have some healing in their writing. It seems to heal them or waken them up or show them something or teach them something. So if they're doing fiction like you do, you're sitting there writing about these characters, and all of a sudden, dang, your character teaches you something, right? You're like, whoa, what did that happen, right? You know, wow. You're like, wow, that was really interesting. And so as you let that come through and come in, it can be very healing. And it can, one of my authors, you know, had a really difficult childhood. Really difficult childhood, and in the process of writing, I feel like it gave her some centering on that. And another one of my authors, someone I'm not actually representing, but someone who just wrote a very racy, sexy, interesting book, had a really difficult childhood, and the process of writing the book itself, I think, was a really beautiful experience, regardless of what's going to happen next, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to agree. I know that when I wrote my Ripped and Ready, you know, I found out, of course, that I'm a hopeless romantic, just a sap for love stories and the happy ending, you know? And as I, and when I look back on it now, I definitely have a different perception about love and a healthy type of relationship. But just like you mentioned, you have some amazing authors under Happy Publishing umbrella, and one of them will be joining me tomorrow. His name is Thomas Weatherstone. So how many authors do you currently have on your Happy Publishing?
About 75, I think.
Wow.
It'll be probably 100 within the next, like, 3 months, because I have a book coming out called The Energy of Happiness, And it's being written by 18 authors, about 12 of which are new to Happy. So I believe I'll probably be maybe representing in the neighborhood of 100 authors at the end of this year. But I believe I'm at already 70, 75 published, and I'll be about 90-something published by August.
That's amazing. And so do you recruit these authors, or how does that process go? How do they find you, or how do you find them?
Well, first of all, I don't have a website, so I'm just going to do like this big old group apology to all my authors and everyone I represent, because you cannot really find me. I apologize for that. You know, I don't know how people find me. That is a really good question. Some authors I do go after, so every once in a while I'm going to go after someone. You know who you are, and I'm just playing. There's one man, I'm not kidding, in Seattle. I've been after him to write his biography since 2007. So I'm on a 7-year slow dip, and he hasn't said yes.
Oh, wow.
But you know what? It's just a matter of time, because it's easier to say yes to Eric.
Right. You know, and you definitely aren't telling a fib, because I have to tell you right now, I don't know how I could say no to you. But you mentioned so many people are overwhelmed by this publishing process. Can you help us get clear on options and how an author can know the first steps to getting published?
So in the writing process, you get kind of this idea of your manuscript, and you start working on it, and you start kind of, and a lot of people who are real critical minded or just, you know, future minded start saying, okay, why should I even write it if I don't know what I'm going to do with it, right? Or how it's going to get published. And the publishing industry has exploded, much like YouTube, you know, and iTunes influenced the music industry, the sort of self-publishing model, and YouTube influenced the television industry, as did, you know, Television Direct and 500 channels, right? So now, the questions, like, if you think about, I'm going to make a television show, where should it get distributed? It's like crazy whack. Like, oh my gosh, there's so many choices. It's the same thing that's happening in the publishing industry right now. And so, first of all, be okay with not knowing everything, because the minute you think you know it all, then 15 things changed.
Right.
And now, like, LinkedIn is publishing people, right? Like, what? What does that mean? You know? They send me these notes, would you like to write for us? I'm like, I don't know. It took me 3 years to get my LinkedIn profile up. I don't know if I want to write for you. But, what you want to do with your book is kind of look at it in terms of, where does it fit, what does it feel like, and what are other books that are like it, and who publishes them, and what kinds of publishers publish them. And that you just start saying, where would it fit, where would it fit, where would it fit? And then for me, having no fear of publishers, since I was raised by them and my dad was raised by one, so when I wrote my first book, I contacted publishing houses, and I actually got 3 different offers, and then I decided which one felt right for me at that time, which was a very small independent publishing house up in Oregon called Wyatt McKenzie. And it felt really good. Nancy Cleary runs it, and she's a great publisher. And I also had conversations with Wiley, which is a much different kind of publisher, for my first book, which was self-help. So I think write the manuscript, and then look at like manuscripts and see what's going on with books like yours, and see who's publishing books like yours. And really, this is kind of your job to find out where it belongs. And some people kind of resist that step, but that step of figuring out what books are like it is how you can program Amazon to find your book. What you want to be able to do, regardless of who publishes you, you want people who go on Amazon to find your book. And they're going to do that by finding books like yours. So if it was about a rapper, you'd look at you know, Jay-Z's Decoded or whatever. You know, if it's about the lifestyles of the rich and famous, you're going to look at books like that. And then you just want to kind of, like, look at keywords and look at covers and look at publishing houses and look at how other people did it that are stories that are like yours. And then you just kind of, like, get advice from people that you trust, you know, talk to other writers. And, you know, we're all just a few degrees of separation away on Facebook and things like that. There's really, once you have your book in your hand and you're selling it and you're sharing it with mm-hmm. people, you know, I think people get way too excited about how they're going to publish it, and they should really be focusing on building a beautiful, quality, deep book that's going to move and change lives. Because at mm-hmm. the end of the day, if you could say your book changed one life, you know, what could get better than that?
Mm.
You know?
I tell you, it's
really
a
changed.
Writer. I see,
you know?
As a writer, when I wrote Ripped and Ready 2, I actually wrote it on a blog is what I did, and people
mm-hmm.
were following. And so it was just crazy how it got started, because I wrote
yeah.
about three chapters, stuck it on there, and then people actually started gravitating to it. I mean, at one time there were 500
yeah.
people waiting for me to pump out this, you
yeah.
know, these chapters. And so I am
yeah.
in wholeheartedly agreement with you when you talk about
yeah.
finding that niche and find out, you know, what it is, you know, and do comparisons to find out, you know, what people are wanting. And then to also find
mm.
your own market, like you said, with Amazon. We certainly are a generation who is a victim of overchoice. There's just so much
mm.
out there right now being
right.
pummeled in. But I'll tell you one thing, like I said at the beginning, happiness is one thing, and Oprah teaches us that, you know, this spiritual search, I mean, she's got her Oprah's master class, and you're actually able to talk and get to know. People are looking for genuine, honest stories, you know,
mm-hmm.
that can affect and change their lives. So, you know, this Happy Publishing that you got, how did you come up with the name Happy Publishing? I think I already know the answer, but I want you to tell us how you came up with it and why you started it.
Oh, my goodness, right? Like, let's be authentic.
Exactly.
I was so joyful when my former publisher helped me build it, and I was so joyful when she said I could have that name. I'm like, really? I can have that name? That's available? I was writing happiness quotations, I think, at the time, and I was writing about happiness, and it just felt good, and it fit. But that doesn't mean all my stories are about happiness. I have books about real estate. I have a book about a woman wrote it about her great-grandmother founding the plains of South Dakota. It's called Something About mm-hmm. Sophia. So if I get moved by a story, that is really Happy Publishing's guidelines, is
uh-huh.
does Erica get moved by the story? And so it just kind of grew out of me wanting to care about my writers. I think in some of my first choices, I gave up some of my rights, and I feel like I wanted to come from a place of honoring the writer because I am one. And I
mm-hmm.
wanted to build it kind of for the authors, like giving them what they needed, breaking it down, clarifying, you know, giving good service. And then the other thing I'll do is I'll help people make choices, and it's, you know, 90% of the time it's not going to actually be Happy Publishing, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say no 9 out of 10 times. So
mm-hmm.
I'm going to help people figure out where their book could or should be, if that makes sense, you know.
Yes, it does make sense. So the question that I have, 75 currently to almost 100, you know, as a publisher, how do you sustain relationships with so many people as a publisher? That has to be like a 24-hour job.
You know, it's really interesting you asked that. I remember when I was at the Grow Foundation and I was giving out money, and not my money, it was their money. And I remember one of the people I would give out scholarships to high school students who were having a difficult time. I remember one of the people at one of the high schools that I gave them money, and she goes, "You know what, Erica, you always make me feel like I matter." You know, one thing I don't do a lot of BCCs. So I almost always email people individually. So even if it's a group book, I might send 20 individual emails versus blind copying everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I like that one-on-one touch. Actually, people right now reach me by text and email and Facebook. So, you know, I think the one thing they don't like about it is that I'm not marketing their books. They have to market their books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people really wish someone, they could wave a magic wand and their books could get marketed beautifully forever.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically I just turn that back to the author and I say, you know what, this is on you. I'm going to give you some instruction. I'm going to share wisdom on marketing with you. I'm going to give you advice. But really once the book's published, that's my piece. And then they're kind of looking at how do they grow the book and grow their platform to sell their books. And I'm going to send them to as many good people as I can. And sometimes I'll get them on television and things like that. I love it when I can do that. But I feel like in publishing each person's book, it's just really a matter of caring and then staying grounded and helping people kick, you know what, because my goal, my joy, one of my authors, for instance, this month is on the cover of Top Agent magazine holding the book that I helped, and he's actually not afraid to say it. I ghost wrote it with him because he has a writing block. He has like 14 disabilities in reading and writing. So he told me the stories, and I helped him write the books. And he's got two now, and so he's on the cover of a magazine this month with his holding up his books. And he was a child and kind of grew up just playing sports and not doing any writing at all. Now he's holding his books on the magazine cover. I'm like over the moon. That's Albert Garibaldi. And I just, like, helping him like that, oh, my gosh. That's good for, like, 5 more years of Happy Publishing being existing.
Well, I tell you what, that's about 20 more years of A Touch of Grace just being so honored to have someone like yourself
sweetheart.
On there. Yeah, that can cultivate a talent. Did you say 14 disabilities?
He was diagnosed with, I think he told me, 14 disabilities. He had learning disabilities. And so when I met him, I actually felt like he had really big stories to tell, and I asked him if he wanted me to help him tell his stories. And he had a lot of passion and a lot of interesting energy, and I was very drawn to his being able to get things done. And then when his book first came out, it was just the first book that came out, and then he did a second one with me. And it's really changed his life. It's opened up his entire world to completely new levels because now he's holding the book, he's showing the book, and he's really gotten over that whole thing of I can't write that a lot of people are afraid of. And I say it's really about telling your story, you know. It's really more about telling your story, you know.
Right. And as I look at Manifest Change, I'm holding my autographed copy, Stop Wanting, Start Having, Take Inspired Action to Manifest Your Dream Life. And you say 19 experts. I think that is fantastic. I think the power of a vision that can have other people that are interested that would want to participate in something like that is a testament of the type of energy you are here in this world. So, you know. Now, I also know, Erica, that you do, and I don't know if I want to call them tutorials, but you have like 2 events a year. Do you want to talk about those?
So it's called Author Symposium. And, yeah, you can, like, follow me on Twitter or Facebook. You can just say hi, and I'll keep you up on those. I just did Author Symposium for June, so I don't know when my next one will be. So usually it takes 8 or 9 people pushing me, and I'm one. My one before that was in January. And I spend the whole day with writers. I bring them into a room, and we just go through waking up their writer self.
Mm-hmm. I love how you put things, waking up the writer self. I remember when we had our discussion in person at the little coffee shop, and I was telling you about all the books that I've partially written, and you said, hold one up and pray on it. And I thought that was the most profound thing. And if it talks to you, then that's the right one that you should read or you should actually write.
Finish.
Yeah, exactly, you know, because the first 5, once I got beginning, middle, end, I was actually able to complete those, and also they were not about me. So it was easy to write something, because I read somewhere where if you're writing about yourself in a certain way, you get bored, and so you never complete it, you know. So my books turned out to be things that, you know, I'd heard about and I embellished a lot. So these author symposiums are usually pretty successful. How did the last one go that you did?
Well, the last one was, I think, the best one in my life. So I left it very changed. One of my young authors, you will meet him, no doubt. His name is, he goes by Shasha, but his name is Sharif Almond. 23
right.
years old, been through all kinds of things. He's writing a fiction book. He wrote a nonfiction book on bullying and race relations in high schools. Phenomenal writer. Got referred through another person I know, another writer. Sent him, his mom basically dragged him to the event. And then he just like was like spellbound, made friends with everyone in the room, told all his stories. And his, I felt like in just connecting him with other writers, and you know, Bonnie came and spoke as a published writer, Bonnie Mayshak, dreamsofmattyfitch.com, go get your copy of that book. Shasha, you can get his book, it's called Equals, he has out right now. I didn't publish him, but what a beautiful day that was. I believe everyone in the room left more tuned in to that writer within themselves and more open to having their books be in physical manifestation. And what greater joy could I have than that? Every single person personally messaged me after the class saying it meant so much. So it was like, I think as I work on my own energy, you know, and as I free up some of my past stuff and get stronger and stronger, I believe I can help people even more deeply with that. And Author Symposium, I believe, will just keep getting better. There will be one in September for a writers group that's hired me. I don't know the dates on that yet. I think it's going to be in late September.
Okay, well, definitely keep me posted. And now that we're friends, I'll actually be able to see that and help you promote that as well.
nice.
So I want to touch basis on this question before I get to the final questions of the interview. And you've just been such a wonderful guest on the show. If you've tuned in today, I have been talking to Erica Glessing. She is a published author. She deals in happiness. Now, how cool is that? She's also the publisher of Happy Publishing. Again, how, if all this happiness floating around, if you can't get happy, you know, engaging with Erica, then you really got to do some rewind on your life to figure out what's blocking your blessing. Because I tell you right now, I just did her laugh, you know, it's just so infectious. So I want to talk a little bit about Intel co-founder and his wife, Andy and Eva. Now, 1.3 million to 7 million annually, you know, how does that come together? And those are some big figures, Erica. How did you come to meet Andy and Eva?
So I live at Intel giving out their money to the community and helping schools. And I got to know Eva and Andy. And I left there to go work at a Packard Foundation, the David and Lucille Packard Foundation in Los Altos, writing for them. And after about 7 or 8 months, I felt like the cultural fit for me at Packard didn't feel as good as it could be. It was kind of slow moving, and I'm really fast, and so it wasn't really a good fit. So I was staying in tune with Eva and Andy from my days at Intel, and I just said to Eva that I was, you know, just kind of like outgrowing that position really quickly. And she said, well, we need someone to help us do our school giving. And I've always in my life helped children in schools and kids, especially kids of, like, you know, impoverished backgrounds. I've always been very moved on helping kids get more education, more access to all the good things there are in life. And so she brought me in to help them build a scholarship program for children, high school kids who wanted, like, a trade path or a practical career path. And so I did. I went in and they increased their giving. That really wasn't me. I was there helping them do it. I mean, you know, I just helped them. That wasn't like my money. It was their money.
I just got
to be of service, you know.
Yeah, I have to tell you right now, that's just amazing. Again, so here you are spreading joy and love and hope from the literary aspect, and that you're actually working in a, as a humanitarian effort to see that children, you know, feel confident enough to go out into the world, you know, following their passions. I think that's a big thing for you, and I thank God for people like you, especially.
Aww.
Thank God for having me having contact with you to be on this show. It's just been fantastic. So what's your biggest dream, Erica?
So in my dreams, I'm just helping more authors wake up their author self and publishing more writers and having the words that people create change more lives and free up energy and help us all kind of feel better about where we are, feel the joy that exists. There's a huge movement right now, waking up of light workers. If I could reach out to people who are singing or dancing, who are being in that arts and just saying, you know, there is a way and follow your truth and really do stick on that. And don't let anybody tell you that you cannot. Don't listen to that. Tune that out. Tune into the places where the universe is giving you yeses, you know, and if I could help people see those yeses, help people get rid of the third grade teacher that marked red all over their paper, you know, help people see that their messages are coming to them for a reason and they're a gift on the planet. And I do believe that every single human being is a gift on the planet. We all came for a reason. I don't believe any one person is better, worse, greater, lower. You know that song, Nobody Greater. Really, all of you listening right now, there's nobody greater than you. Thank God coming through you, giving your message. And if you've ever thought about a book, or maybe it's a song, maybe it's a poem, maybe it's just a kind word, you know, that you go out today and do something kind, you know, and just see how that feels. See what it feels like. Be in that space. If I could turn more people into that, that's really, that's my dream.
Wow. And well, I got to say that it's definitely a recipe for happiness as well as confidence, you know, in life when you are growing up, if you haven't been blessed to have parents like you have that cultivated your talent, you know, it certainly is not impossible to find that core you and get into that confidence so that you can be in a position of where you could follow your dream. I think that what you're doing for the globe is just fantastic. So I know we talked about this a little earlier. How can fans reach out to you?
Yeah, you know, that's so funny because I'm just like, I just don't make it real easy for people, but you can go to my website, which is ericaglessing.com. My happiness quotations, I post them on Facebook. It's facebook.com/happinessquotations. You can reach out to me there. I'm going to just say my Gmail. It's myname@gmail.com. And feel free to connect. Yeah.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Well, we've had spectacular shows here today. I am certainly inspired. I felt like the spirit of Oprah and Maya and all of these great people out there in the world who have just inspired us along the way certainly have been channeled in Erica Glessing here today on A Touch of Grace. And so the question I have is, what is the best Blog Talk radio show on Blog Talk Radio, Erica?
A Touch of Grace.
All right. Well, I'm definitely going to enjoy going back listening to this show, and I just want to say thank you so much. We are friends right now, so if you ever need anything, if you need some PR stuff, if you want to come back on the show, just hit me up, and then we'll work out a date, all right?
Beautiful. Thank you for all you do. And don't forget, you have a guest coming up who's in one of my books.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about him. As a matter of fact, let's go ahead and get that upcoming show out of the way. Thomas Weatherspoon is going to join me tomorrow to discuss his PEPA Sports Incorporated. And I'm actually working on Sharif right now. I was going to try to do him on Saturday, but I already have a show, so I actually sent him another date. So I cannot wait to have a discussion with that young man, because I certainly believe that we need to inspire and encourage our youth. So I'm going to let you go ahead and get back to your afternoon. Erica, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Bye, Glenn.
All right, you take care, honey. All right, ladies and gentlemen, what a happy, happy little bit more than an hour that we just had talking to publisher and author of Happy Publishing, Erica Glessing. Google her. You will find her. I'm telling you, she is someone who has changed my life, and I'm always meeting life changers. So on Saturday the 5th, Pete DiLorenzo, star of stage and screen, will discuss humanitarianism and more. He's going to talk about the Global Cooperation Day 2014 that is poised to break records. So he's a biggie in the industry. I cannot wait to have him on the show. He has shown me nothing but love, and it's going to be exciting. Pete loves to talk, so it's going to be a very intriguing show. On Sunday the 6th, Rico Casanova, African-American music entertainment historian. This is what I call him because he's got so much information about African-Americans in entertainment. He stops by to discuss his The Pros, The Legacy. So summer 2014 is in full effect here on A Touch of Grace. Some special thanks go out to grand supporters of A Touch of Grace, George Livingston, celebrity photographer, Snowman, celebrity security guard, and former bodyguard for James Brown for over 20 years, and I can't wait for that film, Get On Up. It's coming out, I think it's being released on August 1st. I can't wait to see that. I also want to thank World Media, my friends, and certainly, and last but certainly not least, Lewis Randy Rand Wilkerson, the inspiring man behind Coffee with God by Randy Rand. So if you haven't checked out his wisdom, Google him and get to know him. He's really a fabulous human being, as was Erica today. These are my final thoughts, and these are in the words of the late Maya Angelou. When someone shows you who they are the first time, believe them. Rest well, dear Maya, rest well. I want to end this segment with a song I believe just encompasses every call, The Makings of You by Gladys Knight. Thanks for tuning in today. Love you guys. Here is The Makings of You by Gladys Knight.
With a dozen roses, such what astounds you. The joy of children laughing around you. These are the makings of you. It is true, the makings of you. I believe the first told you so. You're second to me. Love of all mankind should be sex or sound of the world's attraction. They're close. Almost impossible to do, describing the making of you.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace,
A Touch of Grace.
Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk.